Hey, it's Christine from Storyworthy. Today on the show, comedian Greg Proops helps me celebrate my 600th episode with stories about traveling.
People think people in Paris are rude. They're not. Yeah. They're direct. And they have a sense of humor. And they're ironic and they're sarcastic. If you are not able to produce any of those emotions, you are not going to be treated well in Paris. Mm-hmm. If you do not say hello in French, and if you do not respond to their sarcasm, if you just lay there like an abalone in the night and die like a dog, mixing metaphors as I do, they'll crush you because they don't care anymore. They gave up. If you talk loud and you don't say bonjour or bonsoir or whatever, they're pretty much done with you.
Today on the show, Greg Proops helps me celebrate my 600th episode with stories about traveling. Stay close.
Hey everybody, this is Greg Proops, and you're listening to Storyworthy.
Welcome to Storyworthy. My name is Christine Blackburn, and I'm coming to you from Los Angeles, California. Whether you're a longtime fan of the show or a new listener, welcome to Storyworthy. You guys, this is a big one. This is my 600th episode. Can you believe that, Greg? That's a lot.
I can't. That is a lot.
It's a lot. And here,
how many years is that?
It'll be 10 years in July.
Oh, my goodness.
So it's almost 10 years. But honestly, between you and now I guess everybody who's listening, we're at 601.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because I dropped a story smash last week. So we're calling it the 600th. It's more exciting.
You know what? Chronology is but a scutcheon, and it means nothing.
That's exactly what I was going to say.
Like, age ain't nothing.
Anyway, you guys, I'm so excited about today because of who my guest is. But I wanted to mention that I hope you enjoyed the show last week with writer Peter Melman. Peter is just, he is always funny, always interesting, always has something to say. And he has a new book out right now called Hashtag Me As Well. And so we talked about the book, and his story was actually about going to a health spa, which is very funny. Have you been to a health spas, of course, right?
You mean like a spa day where you get your hair
like,
did and
like
whatnot?
You go
massage
for the whole day, yeah.
I have done. I never went to a farm or anything.
Yeah.
You know where they make you get up in the morning and you have to eat apples or whatever. I don't know what they do.
You're right, exactly. In other words, it's not like a massage, like a 50-minute massage, like therapy.
Right.
It's more like you do the whole day. And anyway, Peter's story is super funny, so go back, you guys, and listen to that. But not today. Not today. I'm super excited, you guys, because I'm here with comedian Greg Proops. And I have to say, Greg, I've followed your career for about 22 years.
Oh, my goodness. How flattering.
Because I saw you when I first got to L.A.
Really?
Where are you from? And that was 22 years ago. I'm from Pittsburgh.
Oh, okay.
And I just remember seeing you then, and Whose Line Is It Anyway was big.
Gee whiz. When was it then? Like Luna Park or something?
So much going on. Luna Park, exactly.
Wow, yeah.
On
Robertson.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. Isn't that something?
Wow.
So I remember you from so long ago, and I just think you're amazing.
You're so kind.
You just are really multi-talented, and your IMDb page and your resume reads, like a thick book is what it reads like. And I do listen to your podcast every week. You guys should listen to it too. There is a reason why it's called The Smartest Man in the World.
Well, yeah. And now in this era, it seems like it's an archaic name. It was supposed to be a joke. A friend of mine said to me before I started the show, a writer named Phil Bowman goes, you know what you come off like? And I'm like, what? And he goes, really? Like, you know everything. And he goes, do a show, take questions, and brook no dissent, and call it The Smartest Man in the World. And I thought that was the funniest goddamn suggestion. And I have one good quality about me as a comedian. I listen to other people.
Yeah.
Not about my material or anything like that, but like, when my wife says something to me, I listen to her. And when a friend like that says, call it The Smartest Man in the World, I thought, that's the name of it.
Now, your wife, Jennifer, she's on the show with you.
She is.
And I have to tell you, as you know, she's incredibly bright.
Yeah, she's smarter than me. That's why the name kind of hangs in the balance right now. We could call it the smartest couple in the world, but why rebrand at this
point? Yeah, I understand. But boy, oh boy, she brings a lot to the table.
Well, it was always her show anyway, in so much as she was the one who wanted me to do it. And she's the one who often brought all the topics that I'm talking about. So in any case, she, you know, now we put her on mic because in the last couple of years I've had so many bloody surgeries that I've had to do it from home a lot more and not as live as much as I wanted. But we're going back to doing it live more. So,
well, you did over 100 dates last year, you said.
I was on the road with my the improv group I'm in with Ryan Stiles and Joel Murray and Jeff Davis and Dave Foley. We did 100 dates last year, and then I went to Edinburgh and did 2 weeks worth of dates with all the British cast, Clive Anderson and McShane and Frosty and everybody.
You know, Mike McShane has been on this show.
I did not know
yes,
that.
Yes, he's been on Storyworthy and he was on Story Smash.
I can imagine.
He was a judge on that as well. And I got to tell you, when you're a judge on Story Smash, you're going to be fantastic. I can't wait.
Well, thank you. Yeah. I'm old buddies with Mike, obviously.
Yeah, because you started with him.
Oh, in the 80s.
In England.
Yeah. Him and I were a double act in San Francisco in the 80s, and then we were on the English Who's Line together. And yeah, we've known each other 1,000 years.
Yeah, and also Rick Overton.
Rick,
of course, I've known forever and is a good friend, and he hooked me up with Mike McShane.
Of course.
Yeah. But listen, you're talking about all these different places, and it's true. You, not only do you tour a lot, you travel extensively, and that brings us to your topic today, your story, which is titled Traveling. So we're talking about traveling with Greg Proops, and my audience knows that I've traveled extensively because I was a flight attendant.
Ah.
So that will put you in the air. But recently, I haven't been overseas in 5 years. One thing that I always think about when I come back, and I'm wondering what your first impressions are when you come to Los Angeles. Uh-huh. Because when I come back from, like 5 years ago, I was in Turkey.
Mm-hmm.
You come back from Istanbul, and I see Los Angeles as so green. You know,
right?
There's so much foliage. Like, I feel so lucky we live in such a beautiful landscape.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the thing about L.A. is that the weather's fantastic. And really, that's, you know, the beginning and end of the whole thing. You're next to the ocean. The food is good. Like, I don't like show business very much, but that's just a sidebar to Los Angeles, I think. You know,
it's just one of the industries.
Well, you know, I used to say to my friend, in the old days when TV was important, they'd start the 5 o'clock news off with like Roseanne walks off the set. And I'd say, why is that important? And my friend Warren Thomas would say, this is a company town and that's the company.
Wow.
Anything that happens in show business is the headline because that's what we're all about here.
I love that take.
Well, like Hillary today, her whole coming out about Sanders and everything,
yes,
it's because she's got a TV show. Yeah. So she did an interview with the Hollywood Reporter. It wasn't a political thing. It was a showbiz / biographical thing.
So she said nobody likes Sanders.
Yeah,
that's
but he never got anything done, which I loved. It really really brightened my morning, actually.
It's a crazy time to be alive, am I right?
Yes. Far too crazy.
Well, and that also brings me to, and then we'll get to your story, but it brings me to that you seem to have a knowledge about many, many, many different things. So you're very political, but then you also know, it seems, everything about arts and entertainment, which surprises me when you say you're not into show business, because you know everything.
Yeah, I like old movies.
And then you're also, you understand history and different cultures. Do you speak other languages?
I don't. Isn't that awful? My Spanish is wretched, and my French is, you know, puerile.
Yeah.
I can order in the most primitive ways in about 3 or 4 countries.
Yeah.
Meaning I can say numbers, and I can say thank you and please and stuff like that. And I think I can say in like 2 languages. But other than that, it's pretty bad.
Do you do your own travel? Do you do your own travel itinerary now, or do you have somebody do that for you?
Well, I've been lucky enough to be traveling with. I do it. Yes, I do it.
Yeah.
I know how to do it, and my wife knows how to do it, so we do it, or I'll do it, or she'll do it. If we're going to England, which we often do, England's always the jumping off point for everything
because
I can work in England. So we'll land there, do a thing and then move
Makes
on.
Makes sense.
But I was lucky enough to go to Japan and London, Glasgow and Dublin with Danny Elfman and the Nightmare Before Christmas show with the live orchestra last year. And we played some giant ass venues, and John Macherry conducted and Catherine O'Hara's in the show. And it was
I
just
love
great.
Catherine O'Hara. Now, wait, are you singing or are you playing?
I do. I sing a lot in it.
And do you also play an instrument?
I do not. And I'm not a trained singer and I can't read music. So I was in the movie back in 1992, or it came out in 93, when we made it in 91 and 92. I was in the movie then. And cut to a million years later, I get a phone call from Danny's manager. And then we go to rehearsal. He wanted to do the show live again. So he started putting it, because him and John Macherry, who used to be the conductor of Hollywood Bowl, who was Bernstein's protege. Mm-hmm. So when he tells a story, it's just, he'll go, The thing about Lenny was he had such a marvelous sense of humor.
Oh, my God.
And you have to go, did you just call Leonard Bernstein Lenny?
Oh,
and then you see pictures of them together, right? And he's got long hair then, right? Because he's a conductor, composer, a total long hair. And then there's Bernstein with him. And you're like,
flip it around.
My God. Because now he's, of course, an August white-haired gent. And a genius. Anyways, he's hilarious, John Marchieri. One of the great parts of being on this tour, aside from being with Danny and Ken Page, who plays Oogie Boogie, who is the original Old Deuteronomy and Cats on stage. I don't know what he thinks of the bloody movie. And and Catherine O'Hara, who's like a god to me.
Yeah.
I would say next to Jennifer Saunders, Don French, and Madeline Kahn, and Lily Tomlin. All right, I'm getting into too long a list. She's one of my
favorite
comedians.
Comedic actress.
Yeah, so is that John Marchieri goes back and forth between them. We were eating dinner together in Glasgow, and he goes, I saw you. Everyone is on their phone while we're trying to rehearse, and I saw you on your phone, and I just, oh, God. Because usually I'm not on it, but I was a lot that day, and the next day, of course, I didn't bring it out. Didn't bring it out.
Don't
sat like
even.
This, watched him the whole time. And then, so that's his idea of like chastising you just by saying that.
Sure.
He doesn't ever raise his voice or do anything. Sure. And then during the show, he sings every song with me and with Danny and with everyone.
So do you have a good voice now?
No, I don't have, I don't know. I sound like I sound. But he'll sing the score with me because I am post up.
Amazing.
Where you're sitting, I am John Marchieri.
Amazing.
So when I turn
very
to you,
close, yes,
it's
you're
that
on.
Close, and he sings the songs with me, and he'll sing it with me and wink at me while we're in the middle of this giant symphony thing, and that makes me just like, how do you get over that? That's just fantastic.
And so, my gosh, so your wife has seen you sing, yes?
Yeah, I mean, I can
what
sing
she
like
say?
If I sing it, it's copyrighted material. I don't want you to get in trouble or anything.
What does she say about your performance?
Oh, well, I sell it. Volume ensures quality, as you know. And I sing a lot with the improv group because our singer, Charles, Chip Esten, got on the show Nashville about 5-6 years ago.
Yeah.
So he used to do all the singing with Jeff Davis. So when he left, me and Ryan just started singing all
Amazing.
The time. So, I mean, I can sing anyway. But
and you've done so much voiceover work, obviously not just singing. You were Bob the Builder, for goodness sake.
I was Bob the Builder. That was a great period of my
Amazing.
Life.
Amazing.
That lasted about 4 or 5 years. So I was, there's a story. I went to London. They asked me to audition. They wanted an American voice because this is for what they call North America, meaning Canada. Canada and the U.S., and so I went in, and there was these nice women, a company called HIT, H-I-T, and I was in a studio in Soho, and I was doing the part, and I'd thought of all these hilarious voices, right, and I was doing them one after the next, and finally they came over the loudspeaker, and they went, Greg, I'm sorry, would it be possible for you just to do your voice? And I said, are you insinuating that I have a funny cartoon voice? And they go, well, if you wouldn't mind doing it once more as yourself. So I went, hey, Max, Skip, well done.
Wow.
And they went, I came out, and this is the only time it's ever happened to me, Christine. I walked out in the other room, and they went, so would you like to be Bob the Builder? And I went, I'd adore to be Bob the Builder. And then I ran outside with my giant 2004 phone.
Yeah.
And called my voice agent and went, call them back right now before they change their mind.
Wow.
I said, they offered it to me before they offered it to my agent, you know.
So exciting.
So that was a goodie. And then they sold the company and, you know, there's another Bob the Builder now.
But, I see. But your voice is so specific. Do you remember it ever changing or was it always this voice?
It sounded like this always. Someone said a Valley Girl on Valium. And the funny thing is, I've had people tell me over the years, now and again, I had a terrible, terrible, horrible witch of a teacher in college whose name shall go unspoken. And she was a voice teacher, and she told me that I had a villainous hasp like Iago. She disliked me intensely. It's always weird to me when professors hate you.
Yeah.
Because, of course, I thought I was buoyant. I've also had guys say, you should really work on your voice, you know. And then the other thing that happens to me all the time, Christine, is people go, I thought it was you, and then I heard you talk, and then I knew it was you. So they recognize, sometimes
it's
they'll hear
like a
me.
Different entity.
Yeah, they'll hear me. And then, like when we do Nightmare, I'm in a fez and sunglasses and a suit because
oh,
we're
wow.
all dressed up in costumes on stage when we do Nightmare. And we played England, Ireland, and Scotland on the last tour in December. And I've been playing England, Ireland, and Scotland for 30 years.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
People recognize me in the audience, yeah. But there's no credits. They go, is that Greg? Because I'm wearing a fez. And then I'll sing and they'll go, it's Greg. And they all turn to each other and go, it's Greg. Because, yeah, as soon as you hear me talk.
It's so interesting. Well, listen, I'm excited to hear about your traveling story. Let's get to that. But before we do, I did want to remind you guys to follow me over on Instagram and Twitter. Would you do that at Storyworthy? I'm trying not to be very political anymore because it's all been said.
Do
you know what I mean? Like now and then I do have to say something because I can't take it.
Yeah.
But for the most part, I just like other people's things. And I do criticize the president every day because I feel like everybody should do their part because he chose Twitter as the platform.
Uh-huh.
So everybody should at least one tweet a day reminding him that he's impeached forever. Also, you guys, why not head over to storyworthypodcast.com and there's my mailing list. You know my mailing list. Join me there. Lots of fun. And then, listen, it's my 600th anniversary. We are celebrating. So why not head over to Apple Podcasts and give me a good review? That, for some reason, means something. I mean, it does mean something because it makes me feel good. But also, there's some sort of algorithm that is putting things in different places on Apple Podcasts. Although I'm not that, I don't look at that stuff as much as I used to, which is good.
I don't either because for me, it's an exercise of frustration.
Yeah,
we were talking about
exactly.
Before, when I put my wife on the show and the show's been largely her, child as much as mine for 10 years.
Yeah.
A lot of men really don't appreciate that. They don't want to hear a woman's voice. They think the show was better before. The fact that I supported Hillary really rubbed them the wrong way.
Yeah.
The fact that I would support women in general rubs them the wrong way.
Yeah, to read those reviews
and
read stuff like that is really absurd. But that being said, go ahead and leave me a good... Oh, my. All right, you guys. Listen, he's here right now. Greg Proops, as you know, he's a comedian, an actor, a voiceover actor, of course. And you've not only seen him on the very popular show Whose Line Is It Anyway, like we said, you've also been, Greg, on so many sitcoms in small ways and some in bigger ways. But I think about like the old ones like Just Shoot Me or Veronica's Closet, Third Rock from the Sun. But now you're on one of me and my daughter's favorite shows, Schooled.
Oh, yeah. I've been lucky enough to be on a bunch of those.
Which we just adore. It's an ABC show on right after The Goldbergs. And you play this really funny woodshop teacher. It's woodshop, right?
the arts teacher.
The arts teacher. And you have a big mustache.
Yes, they've given me a silent movie mustache.
And again, your voice. No, I'm kidding.
No, it is my voice. What can I do? They're always telling me to tone it down on the show because I am huge. And then I'll go, all right. Let me go big or go home, you know?
And listen, you guys, do follow Greg over on his podcast. You've got to listen to it. I listen to it every week. It's called The Smartest Man in the World. And you also did a book based on that, right?
I did. I meant to bring you one. Of course, I got halfway here and I realized I have boxes of them at home. But when we do Story Worthy, I'll give you one.
Yeah. Oh, thank you.
This is called The Smartest Book in the World.
And then you've done, it's very funny. And then you've done so many comedy albums. I mean, wow. So some of them were called Joke Book, Back in the UK, Live in Houston, We Have a Problem, Proof Stigs In, Elsewhere, In the Ballpark, and the one that I did purchase and I do love is The Resistance, which is just 2018, I believe.
Yeah, that was last year.
Yeah, and recorded in San Francisco, where they know and love you. And it's so funny. you have some bits that people are laughing so hard. You hear you, of course, but people are like continuously laughing in the background. One of my favorites is when you go off on magicians, which for some reason, I have a good friend who's a magician and I go see him, now and then at the Magic Castle. And sometimes it's really fun and interesting and like, oh my God, wow. But then after that, like beyond the like, okay, you blew my fucking mind. Like we've established that. And beyond that, what is happening here?
Yeah.
And so your take on magicians is particularly funny.
Why, thank you.
Listen, you guys, you can find...
The guy who ran the album company thought that was my funniest bit, too. Michael, he would be like, the David Copperfield, man.
Yeah, it's too funny, man. You guys can find Greg over on Twitter at Greg Proops and also on Instagram at Proop Dog. Love that. Proop Dog.
That was my nickname in San Francisco.
It's really funny. All right, you guys, wherever you are, put your hands together for the one and only Greg Proops.
Thank you, Christine.
Yay.
Well, I'm going to tell a couple of different travel stories, if I may, and try not to go too long. We were just in Paris, and it was during the general strike. So when we landed, we came over from London. And normally, you know, you can take the tube into Paris quite easily from Charles de Gaulle Airport. But it was, there was no tube. And so there's, you know, a general strike means everything comes to a screeching halt, like buses, tube, subway, everything. So there were cabs still. And so we got in a cab. And normally it takes, I don't know, you know, 45 minutes, an hour, like any city, not that long, but a ways to get in. Because no one had any public transport, every car in the world was trying to get into the center of Paris. It was pouring rain. So it took 3 hours. And the cab driver and my wife were just riffing in French the whole time. I took a video at one point of the Eiffel Tower because it was raining and it looked really beautiful.
Oh, yeah.
And all you hear in the background is the cab driver and my wife chuckling up and telling each other jokes in French. So we got into town. And by the way, where's my parade? My parade commences dimanche because... the suffering that I had to do that whole, can you imagine 3 hours in a taxi? And fortunately we ate, before, you know, that's critical, right? Because by the time we got in, we were like, oh my God, you know, it's, yeah, always eat before you get on a plane or bring a candy bar with you. So we went out to dinner and we went to this one place and we didn't dig it. And you know how you would walk into a place and like they go, could you wait for a minute? And you wait. And as you wait, you assay the place. And while you're giving it the perusal, all the votes start tallying up in your mind. And all you hear is clicking in the nay category. And you're like, you know what? I hate this now. It was a good idea when we walked in. We've been in here 95 seconds. And I've already found 200 reasons to leave. So it was a cute old brasserie. They made us stand for a second, which wasn't my, you know, I'm never offended by standing. I'm with them from the New York School of restaurants. In New York, you walk in, the place is jumping, and you go, "Can I have a table?" They go, "Have you booked?" And you go, "No." And then they go, "Hang out, it'll be about 45 minutes." And then 15 minutes later, they come over and give you a table because they're testing you. Mm. And I'm always polite and forthright with head waiters, maitre d's, and hostesses because there's no other way to be. The lying is what I hate when they're like, "Oh, it'll be 10 minutes," and then like 2 hours later, they're like, "We're not going to be, you know." I would rather the New York style where they always tell you way longer.
Right.
And then basically just seat you as soon as they can. And lately now, I've dropped all pretense. And if I know I'm going to a place where they might know who I am, I'll go, "This is Greg Proops. I'm here with Nightmare Before..." Like we played in London in December. And there's a really, really lovely restaurant called the Wolseley that does like Viennese food and whatnot. And they're open late. So you can eat after the après theater. So we were doing the improv show with the Comedy Store Players, who are all good mates of mine. You'll remember them from Whose Line Is It Anyway?
Sure.
Josie Lawrence, the brunette lady. Richard Vaughn, she was the keyboard player on the show. Anyway, I wrote the Wolseley, and I said, "It's me, Greg Proops," because I've been a customer there for 100 years. "I'm bringing over the Whose Line. I'm in London doing Nightmare Before Christmas over at Wembley. I'm sitting in with the Comedy Store Players. I'm bringing the players over. I need a table for 6 or 8 or whatever it was." We got there. And not only had they given us this beautiful table in the corner, champagne was produced by the restaurant. And then I ordered chicken liver, because as I said, it's Viennese. And the waiter came over to me and went, "I'm giving you yours first." So now I've just dropped all pretense of, you know, pretending or anything. I'm very direct. I'm Greg Proops. I'm the comedian. I'm here. This is what I want. And it's worked out. Anyway, so we go to this little place, a little bistro in Paris. First, we leave the one that we went into. Then we go to this other one that's a real proper old time, you know, with the creaky ceilings and hardly any signage and the little rickety chairs. And there was a terrible thing on the wall that looked like the back end of a devil dying or something. We mount this staircase that was, you know, calamitous in its construction, coming apart and splinters and whatnot. And we're ushered upstairs, and you can hear them clanging and banging downstairs. The waiter, I assure you, was an absolute dead ringer for Pee Wee Herman. I mean, he had short hair, he had the ears, everything. Kind of like a dashing French Pee Wee Herman. And he was quite nice, of course. What was your point on this, Greg? People think people in Paris are rude. They're not.
Yeah.
They're direct. And they have a sense of humor. And they're ironic and they're sarcastic. If you are not able to produce any of those emotions, you are not going to be treated well in Paris. Mm-hmm. If you do not say hello in French, and if you do not respond to their sarcasm, if you just lay there like an abalone in the night and die like a dog, mixing metaphors as I do, they'll crush you because they don't care anymore. They gave up. If you talk loud and you don't say bonjour or bonsoir or whatever, they're pretty much done with you.
Yeah.
And if they say something funny, laugh at it. And then you're expected, by the way, to have a personality. You're not expected to walk in with a baseball cap and a fanny pack and a Hard Rock t-shirt and go, hey, we want French fries, and be a complete boob. You're going to Paris. Know the rules. Show up. Dress, At the very least, be polite if you can't dress. We order, and I had French onion soup because that's how I roll. When in France. I was going to say when in Rome, but that's absolutely ridiculous to say when in Rome ordered French onion soup. So, we got steaks or whatever. And there was a little crappy wine list on the carte du vin. And I ordered the most expensive one, it was 30 euros or something. I'm with my wife, it was a beautiful night. We took 3 hours to get in. Come on, right? So I go, let me have that one. And he was like, ah. So Pee Wee has totally joined my team, right? It's, can I get you this? Can I get you that? Would you like more bread? A Scandinavian couple comes in who were really cute, probably in their 20s, a little stark, but it was obvious that they had tried it and it might have been unsuccessful and they tried it again and that they were on their path to hoping it would be a success, if you follow my drift. Well, how do I infer all of this? Because I'm a student of people and you can tell how their physical body language was like with each other, that perhaps it hadn't gone as well as it should have or, whatever. Anyways... I'm guessing on their third or fourth attempt or maybe a couple weeks in or something. And they were perfectly attractive and they had no personality whatsoever. So they says to the Pee-wee, can we sit over there? Because we were, upstairs, there's loads of room. And Pee-wee's like, no. Boom, puts them right next to us, right? And proceeds when they order, and they don't order a lot because they're both whip thin, right?
Yeah.
My wife and I are eating cake, we're eating all the more bread, En court de vin, monsieur, he's taking their meal and going like this, throwing it on the table, right? And he's being terrible to them, at which point my wife and I are almost in hysterics, right? Because they're having this low ass conversation, sort of in French, sort of in Scandinavian, sort of in English, right? And yes, Scandinavian the language. And so we finally get the bill. We're kind of in the bag because we've had a bottle of wine and I didn't eat all my steak. Anyways, I descend this rickety-ass staircase to Monsieur, who's standing behind one of those fantastic podiums that you'd see in Paris. It's right in the middle of the goddamn restaurant in front of the kitchen, and there's an old-ass cash machine.
Right.
And he takes a pen, and on one of those, receipt pads for restaurants that is 1,000 years old that you don't see anyone write on anymore, with his little charcoal pencil, goes on there to that, un bouteille de... Well, he starts to add it up right in front of me in French. 30 for the wine, le beefsteak, 40 for the steaks, whatever. And I go, he hands me it, and it's 70 euros. And I go, Monsieur, there must be some terrible mistake. And he goes, well, then, I suggest you call Detective Harry Callahan. And so
wow.
I pay him, and I go, I'll tell you something. I'm coming back tomorrow night to get to the bottom of this. And he goes, for you, the mystery is never over.
Oh, my God. He pulls out a Clint Eastwood reference.
And he said, Detective Harry Callahan.
An American. That was so funny. You met him then. You met him head to head.
Yeah. Because I, he took forever to add it up. And I just went, there must be some terrible mistake. I didn't even look at the bill. And then that's when he said, I have to call Harry Callahan.
Now, I think that couple upstairs sounds kind of sweet. Romance.
They left
Paris.
Before we did. They didn't they did. Drink.
Okay. Oh.
And they, yeah. So Pee-wee was like, you're not drinking. You're eating one little thing each. And he just threw their soup at them.
Yeah. He wants a bill. And when you ordered the, what was it? You ordered snails, escargot?
No, we ordered just two steaks and I had the soup and I can't
remember. What was the expensive thing? Oh, that was the wine.
The wine, yeah. Nice. We got a 30-something euro bottle of wine.
Yeah, yeah.
Which they appreciate.
Yeah, because you can get really cheap wine over there.
It's fantastic.
Yeah, it's
really corner store for 10 euros, you can get a bottle here that's a $30 bottle of French wine.
Yeah. By the way, $2 Chuck went back down to $2.
Did it really?
It was $2.99.
And that's $2.99 Buck Chuck.
And now it's back down to $2 right. Chuck. They've got signs in the store. Tell me another traveling story.
All right. So we were in Turkey years ago. And this is like five stories. So I'm going to cut down the beginning because I've told it too many times. I was doing a corporate gig for IBM. And I was supposed to do stand-up, which we did, in a place called Antalya, a beautiful part of southern Turkey that's above Cyprus. If you look at the map of Turkey, mm-hmm. Cyprus is below it. Mm-hmm. I mean, you couldn't see Cyprus, but it's there, theoretically. And so we went to Istanbul, had a few days in Istanbul, went to Antalya. We're taken to this resort, and it was all Germans. And I was to perform at a neighboring resort that was all Brits. Where all the middle management of IBM had been gathered for 4 days. Well,
how many IBM people? Like 1,000.
I was going to say
I'd say
1,000, 1,500. And this is the '90s, and English people are very badly behaved. And if there's one thing that you can count on from middle management men in England in the '90s, it was that they were going to be inconceivably loud, sexist, drunk, and horrible. Yeah. So, and these are white collar workers. This isn't coal miners. These are,
no, exactly. In other words, they cut loose, yeah, as it were.
Is, right. This is International Business Machine. And Annabella Giles was a TV presenter there and a very nice lady. And they had hired her to do some shit, hang around with them. They had all these talent. You know, they had a bunch of, there's a couple other comedians too. You know, I was just supposed to be the big, big thing, which was horrible because they were all like, who are you? So they're there for 3 days. We get there, I go to rehearsal, and I see Annabelle. And I go, how's it been? And she goes, I had to hire my own personal security guard to protect me after the second day because everyone was grabbing my ass every minute of the day and throwing me in the pool over and over again. And so I'm like, oh my God, right? So that night, I appear, and I'm hidden, and the other comics come out, and they do their thing, and then they go, go mad, go crazy, Greg Proops, right? So I come out, and I walk out into a crowd that's half of them are wearing togas, because that part of Turkey is Greek and
it's
Roman.
It's a Greek thing.
And then some of them are actually wearing like centurion or legionary outfits, right? Like they're in the legion. You know, the brushed helmet, whatnot.
Yeah.
And So I walk onto basically like a Hercules movie here, but instead of svelte, it's horrible English drunk guys. And I'd had to leave England because of a work permit situation. And that had been noted in the newspapers and in the news in England that I had left because I had to. And
well, how long did you have to be gone?
Oh, I can't remember. We went to Paris and then I cried a lot.
A couple of weeks and then you have to go back.
Yeah, then we went back to the States, I think, and then we came back. And then they renewed it again.
Yeah, yeah.
I basically overplayed my hand. I put like 17 work permits back to back. And finally they were like...
It was your punishment.
Leave.
Yeah.
And it wasn't even formal. Like I met with a lawyer at my agent's office and she went, if I were you, I would go. Cause that's how they always act about everything. And I go, well, are they going to throw me out? And she's like, well, I wouldn't say throw you out, but it'd probably be best if you left today. Wow. And, so we left, and of course, I used it forever there. I'd say, oh, I killed a guy in Scunthorpe. You know, in Scunthorpe.
Okay,
funniest name in England. Regina in Canada. That really never gets old.
The Mediterranean.
Oh, yeah. So anyway.
You're at the party.
So now I appear, and a guy yells out, and I've been on stage approximately 2 seconds. Why did you have to leave England? And I said, because I have all my teeth and a chin, mate. And boo. So I struggle through about 45 minutes and I finally finish. It's just horrible. They hate me because I've insulted them gravely at the outset. We go the next day to Aspendos. I rent a car. My wife hadn't been feeling well. And I said, we got to get off campus because the food at this German resort was abysmal. And there was a guy walking around with a rifle. And then at night, they'd have a disco next to the sea, this beautiful, beautiful little inlet. And they'd have a disco next to it. And it would be loud and shit. And I'd be like, you're missing the whole point of this. We're in an enchanted place where the Mediterranean is green, blue, And you're in this quiet cove. In the daytime, you could just sit there and listen
to Lindsay Lohan, she has a resort over there.
Yes, I shudder to
think. So it's the same idea. I mean, really, though, I'm just saying, like, it is very popular for them to have, at least where I've been in Greece and in Turkey, they do have those, like, seaside, you know, places where people gather in restaurants. And then there's always a disco. It's right there.
There's always a disco.
There's always a disco.
And it's for Germans, Russians, you know, the people that go there. The Brits. I had we went to get tea at a stand, an antique stand. We were looking at this guy's wares. And the Turkish will always give you, as you know, since you've been, apple tea.
Yeah.
When you walk in, they offer you apple tea. And so you say, yes, thank you. I love some apple tea. And it's delicious. And so we set to talking. And he was a Turk and he'd lived in Newcastle. And he said when we came in, oh, you're not one of the pigs.
Oof.
Yeah, that was the Germans. Wow. The Turks and the Germans have a long, colorful history together, including the Ottoman Empire, World War I. If you've seen Lawrence of Arabia, you get the drift. So we rent this like Fiat Punto or whatever it is, and from this German in the lobby. And I take her to Ospendos, which is this Greek rune, and then subsequent to that, a Roman rune. And it has one of the most contained and beautifully kept amphitheaters in the ancient world.
Mm.
So... My wife stood at the bottom, mm-hmm. and I went to the top,
mm-hmm.
and it's nestled in a hill, as they all are, right?
Yeah.
With a view mm-hmm. of the land around it. And I went, Jennifer, can you hear me? And she was like, yes, I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Wow.
Because the acoustics were...
That's so cool.
...to die for.
That's really neat.
Such a big amphitheater. It's so beautifully put together. And I learned a couple of things that I'd never learned before, which was, well, they used to flood this one like they did the Colosseum.
Yeah.
They'd put the boards in on the bottom. Because the bottom of every amphitheater was a false floor. There was no such thing as a floor.
Mm-hmm.
Because everything had to come up.
Yeah.
All the sets and the animals or whatever was happening.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, like in, you saw Gladiator.
Yeah.
They're underneath
like under the Colosseum.
The Colosseum. That's why when you go there, it's so disappointing because you just see this weird basement-y thing. And it's like, no, that's where all the action was.
That's where all the animals were and the people. Yeah.
They put a wooden floor on top of that with louvers and escape hatches in it and holes and covered it with sand. And that's how they did it. So then they could take all the sand out if they wanted and fill the fucker with water and have boat battles and kill more slaves. And this place too. But the two things that were most fascinating was there was a turnstile from antiquity, and the tickets were there. And they had some extant tickets, right? They were yay big, and they were baked, and they were perforated down the middle.
Mm-hmm.
So, like it'd say,
they would break it like a cracker.
Yeah, they go section 2 dolphin or whatever, or section 3, you know, lion, snap it. Put one half in the bucket. Now we've counted you.
Right.
Hand the other half back to you.
Right.
And you go up to where your seat is.
I love it.
So you were able, because of the construction of these things, like for instance, the one that everyone calls the Colosseum in Rome, you could fill the place up and empty it out in like 45 minutes.
Yeah.
Because they made all of the hallways go the right way. So if you were in
there's only one way to go.
Yeah, if you were in 65 Juno or whatever, mm-hmm. you're going right to that section.
Yeah.
You're not going any other way.
Right,
you're being sent
way.
To there. Mm-hmm. And then when you leave, everybody from your section comes out.
And that makes sense also. Maybe it makes sense when I'm thinking about like some of those ancient ruins where you see a lot of archways and columns, and maybe that's where the entrances and exits were.
What they call the vomitorium, which has nothing to do with vomiting, was the bottom thing. And then, so you were basically sent, you know, the Senate and the fancy people got to sit down front on couches mm-hmm, and whatnot, mm-hmm. had stuff brought to them. And then the lowest people in society, in other words, women and day laborers were at the very top.
Mm-hmm.
And the Vestal Virgins always had a luxury box. They were down front.
That was more like the mosh pit.
Right. They got a good view of all the, you know, you see that French painting of the guy romantically dying, and you can see the virgins all watching him from the box in their white robes with their red headdresses on and shit.
Wow.
Yeah. So the Colosseum in Rome, and I think this one might have had it too, there was a shade, a sunshade, that the sailors from the nearby port, the Roman Navy port, Ostia, had a garrison in Rome, one presumes, that worked on the Tiber, and they, from that garrison, would man the sunshade. because it was a series of pulleys and a giant round thing that filled the top of the Colosseum to keep the sun off everybody.
Right.
So, and as the day wore on, because it started at breakfast, as the day wore on and the sun came across the sky, they'd roll out the canvas and tie it to the other side. And
it's like so West Elm.
And crank it over. Yeah. So they're all, imagine a bunch of sailors standing at the top of the Colosseum pulling it.
Yeah.
And so if you've ever been to an event in southern, like Spain or Greece, you know how when you buy a ticket for it, it'll say sol y sombra or sol or sombra, right? Mm-hmm. Shade or sun.
Interesting,
Or shade and sun.
Right.
Meaning in the beginning of the day, I'm in the sun, and then later
it's
I'm gonna in the shade.
It's going to change. Yeah. Oh, that's interesting.
Because the sun goes like that. So I think all of the seats in those amphitheaters were sol y sombra. At one point, the sun
hit
you. That
would be helpful to do now. Why don't they do that now at the Steeler games or in
LA?
They
put those domes up, you know.
Oh,
and then
that's
they have the collapsible, closable domes. But that theory has been around since time began, evidently. So anyways, we go there. We have a wonderful day. We stop at this little roadside place. We have dinner. They're watching Kojak on the TV. And they try to put us next to the TV. And of course, we're Americans. We don't want to watch TV. And like, they're mortally insulted. We were giving you the best seat.
Yeah.
I mean, what is wrong with you? So after we eat the meal, and it was, you know, it was a tabbouleh and hummus and baba ganoush and all that.
Falafel.
Dolmades. Yeah, falafel. You know, really beautiful Turkish food. There's a beautiful colander on the wall. And I go, that's a beautiful colander. And the guy's like, takes it down off the wall, rolls it up and hands it to me, you know.
Wow.
Because Turkish people are. So my wife had read about a thing called the Chimera. And now it's going to be dark. And the chimera is a mythical animal that was part lion, part dragon. And so it had, I think it had hoofs too and horns. It had a lot of things. And it could spout fire and whatnot. So we're told about this chimera. So in our crappy rental car, we drive through this dirt road. And then there's a river. And I'm like, Dewey? Because all I could think of was, you know how many times you see on the news the car?
Yes,
and it's floating down the L.A. River,
yes.
You know, during the flood.
Yes.
And then, or Pittsburgh, it's down, what's the name of that river, though? Allegheny. The car's swimming down the Allegheny. And you're like, why did they drive it into the river? What were they thinking? Are they stupid? So here I am. And I'm like, we have to get across this river to get to the Chimera. It's too far to walk. And she's like, gonna. So,
oh my God.
Fortunately, the river was this deep and we did not get caught. So we get over to the other side. Now, they have tree houses in southern Turkey. Giant tree house so big you could sleep in it, like a hotel room.
Wow.
So we're driving along and then there's some tree houses. And I like, fuck, I don't know where this Chimera is. Well, let's stop. So we get out and the people at the tree house go, hi, how are you? In English. Canadians. And I'm like, we're heading for the Chimera. Are you guys open? And he's like, well, not yet. And I'm like, well, could you make us some tea? And, you know. So the guy makes us tea. And we have candy bars. Like, I think it was Kit Kats or whatnot.
Yeah.
And we
spice tea.
Right. We have apple tea. And his girlfriend's Canadian, too. They're from Edmonton or whatever. And he speaks Turkish fluently. And she doesn't. I'm thinking, I wonder how fun it is for her. So they're building the tree houses while we're there. And it's an all-Turkish crew of guys. And he's telling me about how he's going to build this. And this is his dream to be the innkeeper of this treehouse in southern Turkey.
Amazing, yeah.
So I'm like, well, how do we get to the Chimera? And of course, he didn't say practice, but he said,
what does Chimera mean again?
It's Chimera, a Chimera. Like in the way people use a Chimera now is like it's ephemeral, something that chimerical means it's there and then it's gone.
Okay.
But in the classical use of it, it was a beast that spouted fire.
Wow.
And had many different, as I say, attributes of lots of different animals. In that almost a Assyrian way where they put 17 animals together. And it's like, you know. So he goes, you can walk down the beach. That takes a couple hours and you'll never get there in time. Or you could take your car and drive it right to the base of the mountain and then follow the rocks and shit. And I'm like, okay. So we drive to the car. It's getting kind of dark. There's no signs. There's one crappy sign, but there's rocks piled so like Boy Scout style, you know, small, bigger, biggest that way. So we're following those. It's getting darker, darker, darker. You're supposed to bring a flashlight, but of course we're tourists and we have a rental car. So.
This is so like the Brady Bunch when they were in Hawaii.
Right?
Yeah.
So now we're clambering up the mountain and you get to the top of this rocky field and there's a plane, maybe 150 yards across. And out of it, coming out of various different fissures and vents, is blue-orange gas like you've turned an oven on. And you can hear it like you hear an oven. The gas eating the oxygen. And all of the flames are 3 feet high, and they're strewn everywhere. It's gas coming out of the ground that's on flame in this rocky field in the southern part of Turkey. There's a child, as there always is in every subpart of the second and third world, with a case of beer and Cokes and waters, making apple tea over one of the eternal flames.
Wow, that's
he goes,
so funny.
Do you want a Tuborg or whatever?
Yeah.
And we're like, no, we're okay. And I have a picture of my wife crouching next to one of the flames.
Wow.
From the top of this hill, because it was a bit of a hike, the Mediterranean. Well, in Homer's day, 7,000 years ago or whenever, Homer told stories. And by the way, his stories were old when he told them. Evidently the flames were much higher, mm-hmm. 6 feet high. They're like 3 feet high now. It's mentioned in the Iliad. The sailors could see it from the sea because we look back down the mountain and there's the sea. Mm-hmm. So if you were sailing by, you could see these flames in the night, hundreds of feet above you.
Yeah.
And they thought it was Vulcan's Forge. That Vulcan's Forge was located under this because the flames, everlasting jets. So now we realize it's going to be full dark soon, and we have no flashlight, and we have to go back down the hill that we came up, of which, by the way, there's Lycian temples shrouded in undergrowth that are 8,000 years old.
It's so exquisite. Are you taking pictures, by the way?
There's some pictures. In those days, it was with a camera.
Sure.
This is the 90s.
Film.
And a film camera. I think a little crap one that ABC gave me when we were making Whose Line, that was like a sport camera. Mm-hmm. So part of it was plastic, like that meant you could go in the water or something. Mm-hmm. There is a picture of my wife wearing a suit. She's wearing a suit, and she's crouched next to the flames.
Oh, good.
That was for posterity to show that we were actually at this bloody. So we go back, and in a room is a fax, because this was those days, a thermal fax, you know, the rolly. And it's from the British people who were putting on the event, of which I was supposed to appear one more night and do more comedy. Look, we've been having a bit of a chat, and we've decided that it's perhaps best if we do the award ceremony without you.
Oh, wow. Oh, wow.
We've been having a bit of a chat. So my wife and I are so excited
we're
high-fiving each other. We rubbed the fax paper all over each other. We were like, we have two more days in Turkey and we don't have to do the gig.
And you still got paid, I bet. Yep. Oh, that's great. Man, you have traveled extensively and you guys really do find off the beaten path places.
Well, that one was pretty wild. That was all Jennifer.
That is wild.
In the guidebook, it said the Khmer is nearby, but it's like a 2-hour drive. You know, you have to drive to it. So let's go.
What an adventure. Is there any place that you really want to go, the two of you?
Oh, Egypt, yeah.
Yeah.
Egypt.
And have then you back been to Africa?
Only Morocco.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't, so no.
Africa would take like 10 trips.
Right?
I mean, it's just so vast.
It would take a million trips. That's the thing is like, I'm getting older, and I want to do all this before I can't walk around anymore.
Yeah. Do you try to obviously mix business with a trip?
Yeah. And
that makes sense,
that's
right?
Jennifer's always complaint is that it's always a gig and then the trip after the gig. But
The gig
it helps
makes
fund
the trip,
right. It helps
course.
Fund the trip.
Yeah. It only makes sense.
So, you know, sometimes we're able to just do both and it's great.
Has she always spoke French?
No, she learned. She learned.
It's wonderful.
Yeah, in San Francisco and in London, she learned. I mean, you know, I don't think she speaks it like fluently, but certainly well enough to get around town.
So now let me ask you about your intelligence. I'm not kidding. Okay, when I was a kid, my brother used to sit on my stomach and pin me down and read from Civil War books.
Wow.
You know what I mean? And just, it'd be, you know, Sherman marched to Atlanta. Yeah. And there would just be, I really didn't absorb the information, but he wanted me to know so much.
Is he a professor now?
No, he's not, but he is super smart. He's very bright. But my question is like, so have you always been this kind of, had this thirst for knowledge and facts?
It's changed over the years, the focus, obviously. When I was little, it wasn't so, you know, it was a straight Western narrative.
But were you looking at encyclopedias or were you going to the library?
Oh, yeah. I asked my parents for an encyclopedia set when I was like
which
seven
was
or
your,
eight.
Which one did you
World
have?
World Book.
World Book was the rockin'est, yeah. Man.
Had good visuals.
You had the best. World Book was like the Apple. It was like the iPhone of the 70s.
Right.
Fuck that Britannica.
Well, there was Britannica, but I never wanted it that much.
The World Book had more pictures, glossier
way more
pages.
Pictures.
Glossier pages.
Yeah. It was like a big National Geographic.
So then over the years, of course, all the resources change.
Yeah.
And now do you go someplace particularly online? I mean, besides Wikipedia.
Wikipedia is useful to sort of starter kit you toward facts. But yeah, I know you are. Well, I mean, I had to do that book. And it's so tempting and easy to just go to Wikipedia and repeat shit out of there. But I realized if I did that, everything would be wrong in the book because almost everything's sort of misrepresented.
Skewed.
Yeah, let's put it
right,
that way.
Right.
I don't know that they're lying so much as it's just not the story in total. So I didn't. I didn't use Wikipedia. I went to books and sources and things that had been vetted.
Do you have bookstores that you frequent?
Oh, yeah, sure. In Los Angeles, Book Soup, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Esawan over... Issa Rae had it on her show because it's in a famous black neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a wonderful bookstore full of... if you want to get into African-American literature, art, politics, cooking, music, that's a really great bookstore. It's called Esawan.
So both you and your wife are clearly bright. So do you take recommendations from her on what to read, or does she take them from you? Or
yes.
Or are you always like, okay, you learn about this and I'll learn about that?
It's a little bit like that. She definitely has read books that I haven't read. Even at this late date, we've been together so long that I haven't read books that are her favorites. And she won't read a couple of authors that I really like too.
Yeah. How do you plan your podcast? I mean, you obviously have there's a structure.
Yeah.
A bit of a structure.
Yeah. I mean, I improvise within it, of course. And I usually, I'm smoking and drinking while I'm doing it. So I like to free fall a little bit. Doing it live, I like to start by telling a bunch of anecdotes and then dropping the thread of one anecdote, picking up the thread of another, and then work my way back around mm-hmm. to finish the anecdote. Mm-hmm. It's sort of my general drift. Or keep getting sidetracked.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is I learned long ago to accept all mistakes and incorporate them immediately into what you're doing. Never deny them. Never refute them. Unlike most... not, I don't want to go into politics, but like a lot of men you see, men never like to admit they're wrong, which I don't either. But when I'm riffing and I make a mistake, that's where all the gold is.
And you mean when you don't get a laugh or when you say something incorrectly?
When I mispronounce something or get the date wrong or whatever, or especially mispronunciation, because it can lead to so many hilarious.
But it's when people call you out, right?
Well, sometimes they will say you got this wrong, and yeah. I'll read those. I used to read them on the air a lot more. We called it addendum errata. Ad infinitum and Eric Estrada. And I would, because people would write me and go,
I love that.
Yeah, you got this wrong. And I'd go, so I'd read the actual correct thing to correct the record. Because I don't like that Meghan McCain school of opinionating where you go, well, I don't know what the real story is. I just know how I feel. And mm-hmm. I'm going to cry if I lose the argument. And it's like, I don't dig that.
Yeah.
I lived in England too long. And in England in the 90s, my wife and I learned at the very brusque end of a conversational gambit that you don't assert some nonsense without backing it up.
Yeah.
If you're at a cocktail party or any kind of do after show soiree in London, and there was a lot of bright people in London in the 90s, a really highly charged atmosphere full of writers and comics and musicians and, you know, you'd say something like, oh, I think the world's run by people who blur, blur, blur. And someone would go, oh, really? Is that what you think? And what would lead you to think that? And then they contest you.
Yeah.
Because English people like arguing more than they like sex. To them, arguing is like foreplay. You could spend a whole night with an English person and in a heated disagreement. And at the end of it, they'll go, that was marvelous. I quite enjoyed that. They're never mad about it. You think the next day when you call them that you're going to have to apologize.
Yeah.
And to them, it was like...
But that's what they want.
Oh, it was like cold German wine. Yeah.
Conversation.
Just... They love
if
it,
it could only be smash. That way with families, you know, where at the end of the day it would be fine. You know?
No, Americans don't know how to argue, and we've really dropped it now. And the English have too, let's be honest. Their intellectual capacity for
it's
argument.
It's an interesting time to be alive.
Yeah. Here it's, I disagree with you, eat shit and die, bang, bang, bang. There's no more you know, politics is the least arguable thing right now. And part of the reason is, and then I'll drop this subject because I loved where you were going, is that when you add Nazis and white supremacists to the mix of politics, there's no more arguing. And I don't mean on their side. I mean on my side. Yeah. There's nothing to argue with. My family's Jewish on my father's side, and plenty of them were killed in the war. And I don't dig white supremacists and Nazis. I don't have to justify not digging them, and I don't have to justify disagreeing with them.
Yeah.
If you're a Nazi and you're coming at me with white supremacist bullshit, you're wrong and I'm right. Mm-hmm. So that's, I mean, that whole, you know, they love to play the whole, there's no more civility. I don't have to be civil to Hitler.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
too many people were. That was part of the problem.
The reason why we're in the state we're in right now is that we didn't immediately contest the election, recount the votes, and put her in, knowing what we know. And now that we're having to have this giant trial over.
But how could we have changed the Electoral College? It was what it was.
Well, the slave state has prescribed so many things, Christine. I mean, you know, the Senate, the prison system, the Electoral College, police force, everything in this country is built upon the slave state to make sure that women and people of color just aren't heard, and they keep getting,
and that's the gerrymandering
ground under the wheels. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And they, part of what is part of this hysteria of electing someone as inconceivably shockingly awful as they did, putting him forward and going with him when they had every chance to dump him.
Right.
There were 17 people running.
Right.
17 people were running against him. When he went and made fun of the disabled reporter, yeah, that should have been a moment when they all went,
the first, you know,
let's just not have this guy.
Yeah.
Let's get a more representative George W. or Reagan type, who's basically a Nazi.
Jeb,
right, a Nazi, but they can go, hi, how are you?
Yeah.
Christine is such
And they have done public service.
Right, like Mike Pence. He's the, you know, he's got that AM DJ thing going on. I don't know what I'm talking about, and everything I say is a bloody lie, but by God, that's a beautiful, beautiful pie you've got there, Christine.
It's like he's wax.
Yep.
Oh, it's so creepy.
They had that opportunity, but they didn't. They went full bore crazy dog.
I mean, right. And now they've gone too far. Now it's beyond stubbornness. It's beyond, you know, trying to save face. They're just now in Lunaticville, and it's a cult.
So that whole listening to both sides thing is like, there isn't really both sides to me anymore. If you want to argue over like what the tax rate should be, or you want to argue over what our geopolitical stance on oil is, those are political things. When it comes to you want to put babies in cages, you want to build a wall, you want women to not have healthcare, then we've stopped talking about normal things and we've become Nazi enabler.
Yeah. Yeah. I tell my daughter every day, this is a bizarre time. This is just bizarre in our history. And the idea that it's going to all be in history books one day, like this isn't it. This is going to relive itself over and over and over. And then there's going to be a musical and, you know, it's just going to be called Trump. And it's hopefully Lin-Manuel will do it. But if not, you know, somebody will do it.
You're right about that.
Listen, I can't thank you enough for coming on today and sharing my anniversary episode here with me. Thank you. You're just so interesting.
You're very kind.
I think that your show could be called the smartest / most interesting man in the world.
Sadly, then I'd be the Dos Equis beardy guy from a couple of years ago.
Yeah, but he's just the... What did he go by? Did he say the smartest man?
I think he was the most interesting man in the
most
world.
Interesting. He was most interesting.
Jeremy Irons' character on The Watchmen, I believe, is also the smartest man in the world.
Okay, well, you are there, man. I'm telling you. And best of luck traveling this spring. That's exciting. And then we'll get you on Story Smash as soon as you're in town.
Okay.
I'll give you the dates, and then you can... you know, we can look at your schedule because you will be so fun on that. I really, really look forward to it.
I do too.
All right, you guys, I got to wrap it up. I want to thank you so much for tuning in today. As always, find Greg over there on Twitter at Greg Proops, and then follow me over there as well at Storyworthy. And listen, guys, I super thank you for all of your, can I say loyalty? Is that the way to go?
Sure.
There are people that are just loyal to my show, and I appreciate it so much. And I know there's choices out there in your storytelling podcast, but I appreciate that you choose this one. And listen, one more thing. My solo show is back on Sunday, February 16th at the Lyric Hyperion Theater here in Silver Lake, California. It's only $10. February 16th. $10. If you can't afford it, I will comp you, because that's how much I want you to come to my show. Surviving the Ride, you guys, February 16th. All right, you guys, one more time on behalf of the very talented Greg Krubs, thank you so much.
Thank you, Christine.
My name is Christine Blackburn, saying make it a story worthy week.
Thanks for joining us on the Storyworthy Podcast. We'll be back next week with all new stories. Subscribe to Storyworthy on iTunes and visit the Storyworthy website at storyworthypodcast.com. I'll keep you safe.